Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Paranexus Universe. This is your host, Doug Kelly, here with my co-host, Grant Rubendunst. Hey, Grant, it's been a couple of weeks, huh?
Yeah, man, it seems like forever, Doug, but it sure is good to be back, and Happy New Year, everybody.
Yes, indeed. Happy New Year to everybody. Today is Thursday, January 8, 2009, and it's going to be a mucho bettero year, right?
Oh, no doubt about it.
And just for those of you who don't understand that, mucho bettero means much better in Spanish. Speak any language. All right. Just a couple of housekeeping things we want to throw out there before we get into the program tonight. Just want to make an announcement that Bill Nell is no longer a consultant to Paranexus or a member. And if you want to know why, you just need to do a search on Bill Nell. So that's a K-N-E-L-L, and you'll find out why. We have got a couple of shows booked so far this year, and we're looking for guests. So if you know of somebody that you would like to see on the show, you know, shoot us an email. We'd love to get your ideas. We've got several people that we're talking with and trying to get on the show. We've had a number of great people on the show, such as Dr. Roll and Stanton Friedman and David Jacobs. And here recently we had Daryl Sims and, yeah, Michael Cremo. We just had Frank Rascino. We've had
Freeman.
Yeah, I mentioned him. John Hutchinson. We've had a lot of good people. Not naming them all, but yeah.
Almost.
Mm-hmm. So we're looking for some great guests, and we do have a great guest on the show tonight, Jeff Danilek. And Jeff, did I pronounce your last name correctly?
Absolutely perfect.
Very good. Well, welcome, Jeff. It really is great to have you on the show tonight.
Well, it's great being here, guys.
And I read Jeff's book. Please forgive me. Tell me the name of it again. The Case for Ghosts, or no?
Exactly.
Oh, okay. The Case for Ghosts. Read that a few months ago before we even thought about having Jeff on, and I was really impressed with the book, and I highly recommend it. And you can get it on Jeff's website, and we'll be stating that website several times through the show tonight. OurCuriousWorld.com. Correct, Jeff?
That's it.
Great. So it's good to have you. Let me just read a little bit of your bio, and then we'll get some of your background. Jeff is a native of Minnesota, but a resident of Colorado since 1969. And this is in his words, "My life has been a journey that has taken me down many different paths, some good, some not so good, but all of them useful in my journey. After a stint in the Navy as a navigator and briefly an air traffic controller, I attended the Rocky Mountain College of Art and Design, specializing in illustration and graphic design. Since then, I have worked for a wide array of employers, from the public school system to the aerospace industry. I even worked for a couple of years laying out an international magazine for a local televangelist, who shall remain nameless to protect the guilty." I love that state. "I currently live in Lakewood, Colorado." That's where I grew up, by the way. And with my wife, Carol, and our two sons. Jeff, again, great to have you. And tell us, how did you get started in it? Where did your interest come into life in the paranormal or the anomalous?
Well, you know, when I was a kid, I was into the Bermuda Triangle and UFOs and all that stuff. I just thought that was fascinating. Kind of put it in the back burner for the next 20, 25, 30 years. Then I started to think, you know, I kind of like to write. Maybe I could make a living doing that. And so I thought, well, what do I write about? Oh, I know. How about the paranormal? And so I started doing a little research, and I decided that instead of just writing the same books that are out there, that I would try to take a little bit different slant at some of these things and a little bit more objective approach. So that's what I've been doing for the last 5 years.
That's good. Well, I think you're...
How would you say your approach differs from other people in the field, Jeff?
Well, I'm much more of a skeptic in a lot of these things. To me, stories are just stories. I'm more interested in not only the evidence, but I'm also more interested in the what-ifs and why-fors. In other words, if you tell me that an alien spacecraft crashed, that's interesting and cool, but I want to know, well, okay, so how come the aliens don't try to recover it? How come, how do we keep that a secret for so many years? You know, those are the kinds of things that I was interested in that a lot of people sort of overlook, I think, in this area.
Mm-hmm. So you said a lot of folks are in it because it's scintillating and you know, and exciting, but some in their rush to embrace it, they overlook a lot of details sometimes. Very important.
I don't think
details.
There's a lot of critical thinking skills are applied to these fields. And I think people enjoy it, and it becomes very personal to them. But once you get to that kind of a place, it's hard for you to really stand back and look at it objectively.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what I appreciated about your book, you know, The Case for Ghosts. You know, it was just the thing that I liked about it is there was no preconceived notions. It's like, okay, here's what we got. Let's look at it. Let's see what we got. Where does it take us? Which direction does it go? And, you know, that's really the way that we approach our research and our investigations. We don't go in with preconceived notions. We don't go in believing or disbelieving, because either way, you're still a believer. We go in and say, hey, what do we got? Let's see where it takes us. Pretty much as simple as that.
Yeah, and that's really the only way you can get to the bottom of these things. I think that there are some real mysteries out there that need to be looked at, and a lot of the time it gets lost in the sensationalism, and you're not really getting the kind of research that these subjects, I think, deserve. So that's my little way of maybe helping that along.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of times those people kind of tend to, I guess the latest example would be the whole Bigfoot thing, the Bigfoot in the freezer, and, you know, how that, I mean, it's not related to UFOs, but it is in the sense that, you know, somebody tried to pull the hoax, and think of how sensational that was for a few days before, you know, turned
into... Well, I thought it was amazing that so many people seemed to buy off on it almost immediately as soon as it was announced. And you know, for me, I'd like, okay, you got Bigfoot in the freezer, let's see it. You know, then I'll tell you what I think.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are just already all over the place, you know, so it was amazing.
Yep.
Yeah, it was, you know, and there's other things that go on, these hoaxes. And one of the things that I didn't mention to our audience when we started up is just as a reminder, if you'd like to call in and ask Jeff any questions, we'd love to have your calls. The numbers are on your screen, 347-945-7799, or you can use the click-to-talk button if you have a headset on your computer, and there's no charge for that call, of course. You can also get in the chat room and ask questions. We'd love to forward those to Jeff as well. So, Jeff, your latest book is UFOs, The Great Debate, right?
Absolutely.
Tell us about it.
Well, I'm doing for UFOs what I did for Ghosts and for Atlantis and all the other things that I do. This is an area that I was kind of leery about getting involved in because there is a lot of strange stuff with this. And but I kind of fell into some situations and was sort of compelled to look into it. And I guess this was kind of my way of getting back at the whole sensationalism part of it. So I wanted to say, okay, you know, what are UFOs? What explanations are there for them? What if they were here, what are they doing here? Why might they come here? You know, how easy is it to reverse engineer something? That's a big subject right now. Everybody believes that, you know, we got spaceships from Roswell and we've been reverse engineering them. And I just want to get people to think through these points and think, okay, how likely is this to happen? And, you know, how likely is there to be aliens out there, and how likely are they to visit us? And so that's kind of the way I wanted to approach it, and that's what I put together as best I could in this book, and I hope that people will read it and come away with not believing or disbelieving, but just saying, some good points I should remember next time someone tells me, that they've got a spaceship in the backyard.
Well, here's a question from Diane in Australia. Did you cop any flack from the UFO community for being so analytical when researching in that manner?
Actually, the book just came out in December, so it's a little early. I'm expecting to catch some flack probably at some point, but so far I haven't gotten a lot of it. I've gotten some correspondence from a couple of people, from email, who have been kind of upset with me. But you want me to name names? Or?
Well, you don't have to name names, but what are they upset about?
Well, one gentleman is a big name in the UFO community, and I must have written something about him he didn't like, and he just, out of the blue, he starts writing me and saying, you don't know what you're talking about. So I went back to him and I said, hey, look, you know, read my book, see where I'm coming from, and then if you want to carry on a conversation, we'll get back together.
Mm-hmm.
And so he agreed. And so I'll see what happens if he gets back in touch with me and we start a dialogue. But those are the little kind of things I sort of expected, and I think that the more airtime the book gets, probably the more that kind of stuff I'll get, and that's just part and parcel of the of the industry.
Yeah. Jeff, did you use any, now in your book? I regret I haven't read it yet, but did you use? How did you approach it? Did you approach UFOs on the basis of famous cases or the scientific data or what little scientific data we have? Or how did you approach that?
Well, I'm more of a theory person. I like to ask questions about, how these things might work.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do is I don't really talk about different cases very much. I don't have a litany of events. I don't have any pictures of flying saucers or anything in it. What I do is I say, okay, if they're here, why are they here? And then how can they stay here without us seeing them? Are crop circles part of what they're doing? What are they up to? Those are the kinds of questions that I like to ask.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not specific to cases. I'm more general, but just more of a what if, what does that make sense kind of a thing.
Sure.
Well,
now, do you think that if somebody is visiting us, do you think that's extraterrestrial in nature, or is it interdimensional?
Well, when you get into interdimensional things, you're kind of getting into an area that's very speculative. I guess I have a better understanding or a better feel for the idea of extraterrestrials than I do of interdimensional things.
Okay.
Simply because I understand the concept of life out there in the universe. So I kind of work from a more simplistic approach, I suppose, and I usually assume that if we are being visited, that these are probably carbon-based life forms from other planets similar to our own in our own galaxy, rather than interdimensional beings.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you think they have any particular agenda in visiting us?
Well, I think they do. Because what I did is I tried to put myself in their place, or in our place a couple hundred years from now. We're going to go out into the stars, and we're going to encounter these different civilizations. What would we do? How would we want to approach each one? And so I do think they have an agenda. Part of it is, I think, just to observe us, to see how we tick, get kind of an idea of how we work, how we function as a culture, and slowly get us acclimated to the idea of first contact. So I think there's a lot of things going on several levels, and there might be more than one race involved, probably scores of races that are involved in this to some degree.
Do you think our government is avoiding telling us what's going on, or that they have party to this information, or that they're just as puzzled by it as all of us?
Well, I think that kind of a little bit of all three. I think, first of all, I don't know if a lot of the government takes it seriously. I think to some people it's a joke, and it's always going to be a joke until they hear somebody land on their porch. And to other people, I think there probably is some classified things that the military does know about, for example.
Oh, probably to their advantage, to let us think that a black project or black ops is alien, because then they can have it all laughed off.
Right. That, well, another point I make in the book is that, let's say you use some kind of a sophisticated top secret device, some kind of a satellite, let's say, and it picks up one of these craft. Well, in order to release that information, you have to demonstrate that you have this technological capability. So a lot of times I think information is suppressed because you're trying to protect our technological abilities, our capabilities from foreign adversaries.
Sure, like
so there's
from
a lot of
different standpoint, national security.
Exactly. And then there's also the point that I make in the book that there are people who are worried about their careers. They don't want to let the fact that, you know, someone on their airbase was chasing flying saucers around out, because that could hurt their chances to make general. And
mm-hmm.
you know, things like
mm-hmm.
this. So there's a lot of personal ambitions involved and things like
mm-hmm.
that too.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm so, very leery of the idea that there's this big international cover-up going on multiple levels, and there's always people that are in on it and know all different. I mean, I'm open to the possibility, but it just doesn't sound to me like any government I've ever seen in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Well, it'd be hard to keep a secret of that magnitude covered up for so many years.
Oh, absolutely.
And compartmentalized. It would be extremely difficult. Let me ask you a question. I'm sorry for hogging, Doug, but this is fascinating already.
Go for it.
Where do you stand on Roswell?
Well, at the risk of being lynched, I tend to think that Roswell probably was a mogul balloon.
Okay.
From what I've seen of the original and the very earliest reports, not the ones that came along 20 years, 30 years later, but the ones that were initially made by, you know, Matt Brazel and those other individuals, the materials that they show in the photos, it sounds to me and it looks to me very much like it was a top secret balloon. Now, not the balloon itself, but the elements of the balloon in the tail that they found. And so I accept the Air Force explanation. I think it's a reasonable explanation. There seems to be a lot of people who are able to catalog and document that they were sending up these balloons and what they were doing with them. And the way the military reacted to this debris, it sounds very much like something they would do if it was, in fact, a classified military project. So I'm not opposed to the idea that there could be crash disks somewhere, but I just don't think Roswell is the one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So have you heard any of the talk about Obama being an alien?
Oh, I started it.
You're the one.
It's going around in our chat room now, so.
Well, now, wait a second.
Secrets out.
What country is he from again? I don't remember, so he could be.
We better consult with the Inquirer or the Star to get that information. There's a legitimate publication.
Well, no advanced life form would want to come to this planet and become president.
I've often wondered why they'd want to come here in the first place, you know.
So it just probably makes them feel better about the mess in their own planet, you know. Hey, we're not.
Well, or they can just kind of stand back and go like, my God, look at that giant fire ant mound. Why do we even want to stick our fingers in there?
Watch what happens when they stomp on this part, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so what's your take on it?
On what?
On Obama.
On Obama?
Somebody in the chat room is curious as to your feelings, your thoughts on that topic.
Tell us the truth now, Jeff.
I believe that Barack Obama is completely 100% human.
And, oh, my goodness.
It will probably exhibit that over the next few years.
I'm completely shattered at that kind of a...
You just killed Grant's whole paradigm.
Oh, man. We thought we had a good thing going. Doug and I were going to write a book when we saw that. Oh, well.
Let's improve it otherwise.
Well, let's talk about abductions. Do you cover any of that in your book?
Yes, I do actually have a little chapter about that. I actually approach it from two different directions. One of them is that I deal with the idea that, you know, why do aliens want to abduct people? What is the value of doing this? You may already know everything you need to know about it physiologically. And if you start getting into the gene manipulation theories that are very popular out there, where, you know, they're doing experiments on our genetics. Then you start getting into the question of, okay, how come you don't find this in the, you know, in the DNA? How come you don't see this sort of drift in these all, you know, some evidence of this happening? So the other way I look at it is, what if extraterrestrials were simply able to, you know, beam us in some way that we experienced an abduction experience without actually having one? In other words, it's all in our mind, and they're doing it as a type of psychological study to see how we respond to these things. And the reason I say this is because the big problem with the abduction scenario, in most of the cases I've looked at, is that these people are taken out of their homes, they're taken out of very public places. Nobody ever really sees it, which I always thought was curious. It seems to me this is something that people should notice. You know, hey, look, there's a guy in a blue beam being taken up to the spaceship there. But they never really seem to see that kind of confirming information. So it makes me wonder, what if these entities have some way of manipulating our mind, or they've mapped our brain and they know what parts of it they can sort of manipulate to get us to have these experiences. And so that's just one take on it. I put that out there in the book and let the reader decide if that's valid or not.
But that's an interesting take, and you know, and that kind of correlates with some things that some of our other guests have thought about. Certainly the mind scan has come up, the ability to get in there, and they have the capabilities to, through that, whatever process or however they do it, to, you know, cause paralysis, if it's indeed true, cause paralysis, plant false memories, do a number of things. And, you know, that in a sense is almost the idea of being manipulated psychologically and physiologically at the same time for purposes you don't know. It's a little bit creepy.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have a story in there that I came across in my research of a woman in Australia back in the 70s, I think, who was an abductee, and she got involved with the UFO community down there. And they were riding across the desert with her. It was two researchers, she was driving. And all of a sudden, she pulls over, and she starts describing this abduction experience that's happening to her. And she's being taken into a ship, and she's being had all these things done to her. And the two investigators are sitting right there in the car with her, watching her go through all this, and say, "Wait a second, what is she doing? You know, she's having this very vivid abduction experience, but she's sitting right here in the car. She hasn't moved." Yeah. And I thought, boy, that is really interesting. That you know, to me, that was like a clue, like a little warning went off and said, "Hey, you know, they're doing something on a level that we're not aware of, that is making people have very real experiences, but completely illusionary."
You know, that's
all of the Martian Chronicles.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that kind of thing.
You know, I've also come across those cases too. In fact, I just read about that case, I don't know, a night or two ago, in a book I'm reading, and it's very interesting because they're referred to as psychic abductions, so to speak. And you know, it is interesting, and that's what we research. You know, that's one of the things. You know, what is exactly going on? Because, like in that case, and I'm sure others, that the person doesn't even go anywhere, but yet it's as real as anything. And if it's not alien, if it's not a third party or a second party, if you will, what is it? You know, what is the psychological thing that's going on? That's my question.
Certainly, what triggers that kind of experience psychologically? You know, I mean, in some cases it might be trauma, it might be stress, but you know, it really makes you wonder.
It's almost as though these extraterrestrials are targeting certain individuals. They seem to have some kind of a makeup to them that works well with what they're trying to do, because these people tend to have some similarities in their personalities. They tend to be somewhat eccentric personality types, and they seem to register very high in certain areas of imagination and things like that. So they might be a really good subject. Mm-hmm. For a kind of a mind manipulation maneuver like that.
Well, you know, in some ways I agree with you, but in other ways I respectfully disagree, because there have been a large number of psychological and psychiatric studies. I can't name them off, rattle them off for you, but where the bulk majority of the folks have not manifested any symptomology that be consistent with, you know, personality disorders or, dissociative disorders or a lot of those things. And really, through psychological testing, they've not really demonstrated that there's any underlying pathology there. So there are some folks, there's a percentage, not all, but there's some that there are no underlying psychological issues there, in the sense that.
Well, understand that eccentricity is not a psychological disorder.
Eccentricity means
that you kind of look at the world maybe a little differently, but you would not be considered, you know, psychotic or anything if you're eccentric.
Right.
And I guess
you could be schizoaffective, you know, and be pretty weird, and you know, and people wouldn't, you know.
Like a schizophrenic or a psychotic personality type would not be considered eccentric. They would just be considered, you know, emotionally disturbed. But an eccentric person is completely sane. You know, they're just like everyone else. They may just have a little different way of looking at things.
Yeah, right. So and that's true. So, you know, the interesting thing about this whole field, and it's not just the UFO field. It's parapsychology, including paranormal research. You know, there's such a wide variety of cases, and many of them you can attribute to sleep paralysis or fantasy proneness or, you know, vivid imagination, but not all. You know, and that's the interesting thing about it. Same with abductions. You know, some of them. You know, yeah, you can explain that way, but some of them have leave behind physical evidence that, you know, it's not so easily explainable.
Yeah, that's a little bit more of an interesting area. When you start getting into trace evidence, people waking up with various scars and things like this, then you do have to kind of look at another layer of abductions as to whether there might not be a small percentage of people that really are maybe contactees to some degree. And I'm quite open to the possibility. I still would like to understand the rationale behind it and exactly what's going on here. But like I said, I don't know, you know, and that's the start of research is when you come to it and say, I don't know what's going on here. Let's find out.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
So here's a couple of questions in the chat from Sharon. And just correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding and my take on you, Jeff, is that you pretty much approach these subjects in an objective manner, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, neither for nor against. You examine both sides of the issue, correct?
Right. Well, I understand the skeptic's point. Now, I can't say that I don't have an opinion about whether there's extraterrestrials. You know, I do have an opinion. But what I'm saying is the case-by-case basis, I approach it more objectively, but I still believe in like ghosts. I believe in an afterlife and things like that. So I'm not a complete pure objective person.
Sure, I understand. Okay, so here's the second one.
I kind of answered that one.
Well, has anyone ever gotten any physical evidence that aliens really do take up space and have a physical mass? That's the question.
Well, yeah, there's actually there are radar traces off some of the fighter jets and things that have chased them over the years. I record an incident over Wavre, I don't know how you pronounce it, Wavre, Belgium, back in the early 1990s, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
A couple of F-16s chased a big triangle-shaped craft all over Belgium, and they did have it on radar. They had it on the individual fighters' cameras and things like this. So that would seem to imply a solid object that's actually taking up physical space. And so that to me was very compelling.
Well, there's been a lot of them, yeah. Cases where there's obvious
configuration of the triangle. That's for sure, the black triangles there.
Yeah,
if anything, they seem to be growing in proportion.
Yeah, like the fish you just caught. You know, it gets bigger every time you tell the story.
Yeah,
this is true. That's part of the mystique, the mythology. But no, I really think in the black triangles, I've got my own kind of theory about that, and I think that they may be government some sort of new type of dirigible or something or a lifting body that you know, just kind of hovers around. I don't know if I, you know, if I buy in the fact that they just spontaneously went poof and went away, but, you know, why not? They may be a great surveillance device for whatever purpose, you know.
Well, the problem with a lot of that explanation, though, if you think about it, the top secret government aircraft is that when the government does develop top secret planes, they don't fly them over public areas. They have, you know, they have test ranges in the desert that they fly in. So when they were developing the stealth fighter and the stealth bomber and all these things, the only you would never see one. You know, they would just be out over the Nevada desert somewhere at night, and, you know, you would never have a chance to find one, you know, over Phoenix or over Seattle. That's not where you would test these things. That's the one big question I would have about the secret government project theory.
Well, the only reason why I base it on that is there is, I think, pretty much there is some documented evidence that during the early 60s, late 50s, when the United States was developing the U-2, that they did do some over the United States flights. It may have been, you know, out in the Pacific Northwest, or it may have been, you know, northern United States. But nonetheless, there were witnesses that saw it, saw something in the sky, a moving object that was reported. And at the time, the CIA used that to their advantage because they did have this new classified spacecraft, not spacecraft, but high-altitude aircraft that, you know, nobody else had, and, you know, the public really wasn't aware of it.
You talking about the SR-71, the Black?
No, I'm talking about the U-2, the one that Gary Powers was in,
right,
that he was shot down over the Soviet Union. There is some documentation that the CIA, when there were reports, when they knew that the, you know, they weren't all that frequent, but when they knew that they had flown in the area and the UFOs were reported, they simply didn't say anything. Because
yeah, well, actually, that would make sense. They would use that as
yeah, it was disinformation that they could use to their advantage because they're maintaining the secrecy of the aircraft. So,
right.
You know, I mean, look, I'm sure that some of those F-117s, those stealth fighters, probably flew over places and folks didn't know what they were. They might have been reported. You know, not all of them are going to stick around Area 51 or you know, whatever, Nellis Air Force Base. They're going to do some other routine flights, but it was just food for thought.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Jeff, on that, back on the topic of physical mass in aliens, are you familiar with any cases in which somebody got a piece of the alien or, you know, interacted with them in a physical way, or the aliens left some sort of trace evidence?
Yeah, there have been accounts of people who have reported having tussled with them, you know, actually fought against them, and I don't think anybody's ever, you know, grabbed part of their uniform or anything. And
bit off their ear.
Lock of hair or something, yeah, you know, their earring, whatever. As far as trace evidence goes, there are cases of landings where they have looked at the soil and they found aberrations in the soil, you know, it's been magnetized, different things like that, which are always real curious. They don't, you know, definitively prove anything, but it does demonstrate that something has interacted with the soil. What that something is, we don't know, but something apparently did. So, yeah, there's some trace evidences out there, and those are real interesting and compelling, and I hope we see more of that in the future.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen a UFO yourself?
Well, actually, yes, I have. Actually, I write about it on my website. People can go to it, and I have a little account on there. It happened about a year ago.
Tell us your website again.
It's OurCuriousWorld.com.
Okay.
If you go to the UFO section, I got a little article on there that says my personal UFO story.
Well, tell us about it.
Well, I saw this actually down in downtown Denver last January 2008. I was attending a little convention, and during the break, everybody went outside, and people started to notice there was something going on overhead. And I looked up. And I was like one of 75 witnesses. What it was a series of small orbs of light, little balls, looked fairly small, maybe a couple hundred feet overhead, maybe five or six of them spinning in a very, very tight circle. And they would be very bright, and then they'd be completely vanish, and then they'd come back and be very bright again. And what I got the impression I was watching was not a craft, but I was watching a demonstration of the manipulation of energy, maybe through magnetism. They kind of felt to me like they were little balls of plasma that were being held in a tight vortex by some kind of a magnetic funnel. And maybe as a display, just to get our attention, who knows. But I thought that was really interesting. It was the only thing I've ever seen in my life where I couldn't figure out what it was, and I got to watch it for a good 3 or 4 minutes. So it wasn't like just a glance, you know, what was that? This was something I actually stood there and studied it and going off my checklist. Okay, birds, kites, balloons, you know, nope. And I never did figure out what it was, but my account's on there. People can read it and see what they think, if they have any thoughts on it. But like I said, it was quite a few people saw it, but I don't know what it was.
Here's another question. Do you have any thoughts on HARP, Bluebeam, and Montauk? Could abductees just be receiving thoughts to act as a smoke screen for government activities?
No, I'm not familiar with these particular incidents. Are they fairly recent, I assume?
No. Montauk was, what, when was that, 40? When was that, Grant? You're the encyclopedia.
Well, I don't know if I'm the encyclopedia, but Montauk is related to the Philadelphia experiment. And the mythology surrounding Montauk is that whatever devices were used for the Philadelphia experiment were carried on in Montauk long after that had happened.
Long Island.
Long Island. ARP was a high energy frequency that the United States government was doing. It was experimentation with radio frequencies and interacting in the upper atmosphere, I believe. Bluebeam, I'm not familiar with.
I've heard of it, but I can't.
Sharon, you'll have to let us know what that is. And I think I'm halfway close. If anybody in our audience is, you know, if I'm wrong, hey, I'm open to correction.
Grant's never wrong except for when he is.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely. I appreciate your support.
Only on days with Y's in them, right?
Yeah. So the second part of that question, could abductees just be receiving thoughts to act as a smokescreen for government activities such as mind control?
I don't think so. I think that the degree of technology that would be required to manipulate someone's thoughts from a distance is beyond anything we currently would possess. For the government to do it, they would have to have somebody come in and sit down in a chair and wire them up and, you know, and do all this kind of stuff.
Brainwash.
But you couldn't do it from a distance. This is what I think the technology on these things is so fascinating to me, how they can manipulate these things like I said, my UFO that I saw, it appeared to me that it was being manipulated from another point somewhere further up. So it's like they have this ability to beam stuff into different places and get right into places where they want to get very tightly without having to be noticed if they don't want to be.
That's a very interesting concept, though, Jeff. You know, I think Jacques Vallée has also kind of alluded to that, too, in that, you know, whatever it is, he's not necessarily saying that it's an alien, extraterrestrial, flying saucer, that it may be some sort of phenomenon that's absolutely indigenous to this planet that we may coexist with, and that presents itself to us in various manners, be it a crop circle or be it, you know, like maybe something like you described, where they're able to come in and manipulate the environment for purposes completely unknown to us.
Right, and you think about for a second, you know, if we took our technology out there 200-300 years from now, if we wouldn't have the ability to do many of these things that we see being done now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what about a million years in advance? What about a million years in advance? Their technology would be like magic.
Well, see, my personal belief is that sentient beings like ourselves, we get to a certain point of technology, and then we actually sort of almost are consumed by it, and we tend not to advance anymore. We tend to just kind of go into maybe another dimension of existence. So I don't really see there being like a million year or technology in a million years from now. I think we would get to a point in the next few thousand years where we would simply just kind of absorb right into the realm of whatever we're at, whatever dimension we're in. Mm-hmm. And we would just, in other words, we would cease to be organic units. We would move beyond the need for a body.
Right.
And we would move beyond the need for technology, in effect. And I think that's where ultimately all sentient races end up when they reach a certain level.
So you feel that they reach a pinnacle technologically,
exactly.
And then when you've reached the pinnacle technologically, the only way you can progress is through some sort of intellectual or spiritual or whatever type of growth to ascend to a higher plateau?
Yeah, I think you actually move from being a physical entity into more of a spiritual entity.
Mm-hmm.
And you move on from that direction, at which point you no longer require technology. You can move with the speed of thought, whatever you want to do.
Sure, like incorporeal life. Do you think that all... I guess one of the issues that I have with that, and I mean no disrespect, is that's looking at it from a totally human perspective. And, you know, what about, let's just hypothesize, what about an insectoid form of life, a hive mentality? They may not approach it anything like that.
Right. I'm limited in what and how I can perceive these things from my own understanding, my own human experiences. So I can't understand how, an ant would look at this situation.
That's part of the equation that we sometimes don't look at. We have this tendency as human beings to anthropomorphize everything. And so, you know, when you have some of these very odd UFO cases where the aliens, obviously have the capabilities, whether it's through illusion or whatever, to manifest themselves, anything from a Nordic type person to an insectoid, it really makes you wonder about the capabilities. And also, we can't fathom the mentality of ants in our backyard, let alone, let's just take for, the sake of an argument, an insectoid or a hive mentality that's couple million years ahead of us.
Right, it's very difficult. But I tell you, I got a lot from Star Trek, because they demonstrated how some of these different ideas work. If you look at the Borg, this is a whole hive mentality, and they demonstrated how that works. And they also had entities on some of these shows that did develop that they made that step from a physical into a spiritual being. So I found that program to be very helpful in understanding some of these different concepts.
Mm-hmm.
I often wonder if Roddenberry wasn't very much of a visionary in that respect with all
this. Oh, absolutely.
He's tuned into some of this.
Mm-hmm.
He's almost like tuned into some of this on some wavelength and was picking this stuff up. It was amazing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly was a gentleman way ahead of his time. And, hats off to Gene Roddenberry and, Star Trek, great program. Great, broad. If it probably wouldn't have been for Star Trek, we wouldn't even have handheld phones now.
That's right. We'll be working on transporters and laser beams.
That's right. Yeah, we're getting there. We're gonna find that Heisenberg, what was it, the Heisenberg compensators.
Yeah.
I thought it was a flux capacitor. I don't know.
All right.
Good job, guys.
Well, let's talk about the, shall we say, spiritual aspect of all of it. And I'm talking UFOs, aliens, spirits, us, that kind of a thing. And let's look at, you wrote a book on reincarnation, the mystery of reincarnation. Can you give us the gist? What did your research conclude, at least what did you conclude in your own mind?
Well, in my own personal perspective, I believe that everything is part of a greater divine essence. Think of it like the Force in Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we're the soul is the essence of what we are. The soul is a part of the greater divine mind, the greater God, if you would. It's think of it as a cell in God's body. And each soul generates multiple incarnations, not only on this planet, but on other planets throughout the universe. I believe that aliens, extraterrestrials, are the same kind of, they're the same essence as we are. They generate from souls just like we do. They might look very different from us and act very different, but they're still generated from the same source. And I think that all of the whole reason for this is that this is God's means of experiencing himself or itself. Because as long as God remains all there is, he can't understand anything except conceptually. But once God breaks apart and comes into the flesh, into the physical form, wherever that is, Now God is suddenly able to experience himself in a practical manner. And I really believe that's what the whole process is trying to do, is get us to experience as much as we can through multiple incarnations in a way to realize the divine nature within everything, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, we're all part of this larger tapestry, and, there have been some people that have postulated that the universe is sentient in that it is trying to discover who itself is, and because we're so an integral part of the universe, that we're just little microcosms of that desire for self-discovery and self-realization, and that's pretty fascinating stuff.
Well, the thing that occurred to me was how many people are there? 6.5 billion people on this planet, and each one of them is going to have unique experiences just to themselves. And how many people have existed on this planet over thousands and thousands of years? And each one of them had a whole life that they experienced in a completely unique manner. And it's mind-blowing to think the vastness of God, that he can or it can experience so many different things on so many different levels over really an infinite amount of time. It's just mind-blowing to me.
Well, and what's really even more fascinating about it is the fact that we carry those genes to some small degree from all those ancestors. So there is some sense of immortality. It's just unfortunate that we can't tap into those ancestral memories of who we might have been a long time ago. But then again, I guess if you want to look at it, maybe those ancestral memories in the unconscious drive us to certain types of behaviors.
Right. Well, if you're into past life regression, which is something I got to experience when I was researching my reincarnation book, you can actually tap into those mm-hmm. memories from previous personalities mm-hmm. and touch into that and find out, what kinds of experiences they had before. And you're right. Those experiences do shape that soul's template so that the next personality it generates is kind of a reflection of what experiences it's undertaken up to that point.
Yeah, and, if you believe in the karma gig that, if you didn't get it right the last time, you're going to come back to do it again all over again and hopefully work, evolve your way up to a more enlightened life form. So that kind of stuff, when you look at it and you think about the intricacy of that tapestry, it's very comforting. Very comforting.
Yeah, it is to me. And that's why I'm not really afraid of extraterrestrials, because I look at them as part of that tapestry too.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I had a little gray show up in my room tonight, I think I could deal with it as just another part of the divine element and talk to it on that level. I might be a little repulsed when it, ate the cat or something, but for the most part, I think we get along okay.
I don't think I've ever heard of a single experience of them eating a cat.
Yeah, they don't like cats.
You never watched Elf, did you?
There you go.
Yeah,
but if we could digress for a second, go back to reincarnation. There's been some real fascinating cases in reincarnation, there was a professor out of one of the universities in Virginia that did some really interesting research with children, who, and I'm sure you're familiar with them, Jeff. Where, I think it was in India. Where they had one guy had actually met a violent death, and this young lad started talking to his parents, who lived in a village maybe 100 miles away from where this guy had died several years before he was born, and started relating experiences and people. And when they took the kid to the village, he recognized his family members, and everybody was really kind of astonished. And also, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's been some children that have had birthmarks similar to where, somebody experienced a traumatic death, have birthmarks. And all that is really interesting stuff.
Yeah, actually, you talked about Dr. Ian Stevenson,
gentleman
who worked on this for about 40 years.
Yes, thank you.
He just passed away, actually, a few years ago, unfortunately. But he recorded more than 3,000 cases of children who had spontaneous past life recall. These are not children that are hypnotized. These are children that, as soon as they can talk, they began talking about their other families, their other lives. And he researched several hundred of them fairly extensively and even wrote a book on 25 of the best cases. He's really worth checking out. If you're curious about reincarnation and you don't know what to think, he's really a good source to go to. It's a little dry reading sometimes, but he really is very thorough. What you're also talking about is birthmarks, matching birthmarks, in which a child might be born with a birthmark on the head that looks like maybe a bullet exit wound. And they'll find out that the previous incarnation that they were had died from a bullet that struck that exact part of the body. And so he also records several cases of that and found that to be very compelling. It's interesting to note, Stevenson never came out and said he believed in reincarnation. He said these were cases that were suggestive of it. So he remained quite objective throughout his entire life as to whether or not there was reincarnation, and he handled it in a very scientific manner. This is, to me, was always very interesting stuff, especially coming out of a evangelical Christian background like I did. When I first began to explore this stuff, it really blew me away because it was so different from what I had been taught up to that point.
You may as well have picked up the Gnostic Bible, Jeff, to be looking at that stuff.
Oh, exactly. But, you know, that's been suppressed for a long time. You know, that's only recently that we even knew about it, you know. So it's
you're right.
All
you're absolutely correct.
What religion did you grow up, can I ask?
Well, I was born into the Catholic Church, but when I became 21, I became a born-again evangelical Christian. I was active in the Assembly of God churches. And then about 7 or 8 years ago, I kind of felt like I wasn't going anywhere with it. And I started exploring other spiritual teachings and kind of led me down these different roads that I've gone down since then. I still have a great admiration and respect for the Christian Church, and I think it was a good place to be for a long time, but it kind of was not where I wanted to finally end up. I wanted to move down and try and look at other things out there, and it's been really great since then. I've really learned a lot of things, I think.
Well, you know, all of them across the board, the bottom line is the one good thing about all religions is they do preach the brotherly love, and you know, and they all bear the same similarities. So there's got to be one common root amongst all of them. And you know,
well,
it's just
interesting because
that you can't embrace it.
If you look at the Western religions in particular, you'll find there's a mystic thread that runs through them.
Absolutely.
The Gnostics you mentioned, there's the Kabbalists and Judaism, and there's the Sufis within Islam. And they all have a very similar sort of outlook. They all believe in reincarnation. They all believe in this oneness of everything. So you can see that thread running through all of them. My take on religion is that it's a valuable tool for some people, depending on where they're at in their spiritual journey. Some people need that. Some people don't. You're going to evolve spiritually whether you're in a church or whether you're not. Even if you're an atheist, you're still going to have experiences that are going to evolve you along. So I see them as a tool, neither a good nor a bad thing, capable of doing either.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's like, they're like nuclear power. Religion to me is like nuclear power. You can use it while you're sitting, or you
that's
can,
a good analogy, Jeff.
Well, no, you can use. Well, think about it. Nuclear power. You can use it to light a city, or you can use it to destroy a city. You know, so the nuclear power itself is neutral. It doesn't care what you want to do with it. It's going to work the same way either way. And same with religion. Religion can enhance your life. It can make you a better person. It can also make you into a real vicious villain, you know, depending on how you want to use it.
Hey, Jeff, do you know, has anybody picked up and tried to fill in for Dr. Stevenson? Do you know of anybody that's doing any current research now on reincarnation?
Actually, I think there are a couple, but I don't have their names. Once I stopped, you know, once I wrote the book and I moved on to studying other, you know, ghosts and UFOs and stuff, I didn't really keep up on it as active as I was before. But I know there are a couple of people out there that are working on it. I think Michael Newton has gotten a number of books out. There's a couple of them. If you go to the New Age area, you'll find quite a few people that have worked in that area. Not probably to the degree that Stevenson did or with the degree of a scientific acumen that he used, but they're still out there.
All right. So,
I don't know if there's anybody who's doing research on past life recall in children like he did, though. I think most of the research nowadays is being done through regression hypnosis, and those kinds of things, rather than the kind of scientific way he did it.
All right. Let's. There's still a few other things we've got to cover on some of the different research you've done, Jeff, and all that. And this seems like a good place to just take a quick break. And so, when we come back, we're going to explore a little bit more about the connection. At least I would like to connection between spirits, UFOs, or aliens, I should say, more accurately, and some of what you've found in other areas, even Atlantis. So. We're talking with Jeff Danilek, author of several books, and I recommend them. I really enjoyed your Case for Ghosts, and I plan on reading all of your books. So there's a plug for you. And Jeff's website is OurCuriousWorld.com, so go take a look at that as well. And if you haven't been to Paranexus in a while, please take a visit there, paranexus.org. If you're not a member, we'd love to have you as a member. We've got some exciting changes coming about in the near future. We're going to be establishing our field researcher network. Many people have taken the CPI course, and so we're going to be inviting them to join the field researcher network if they wish, and there'll be some more training. We're also going to be doing some training on ufology, a little more on parapsychology, and even advanced interviewing skills for witnesses and clients and so forth. So some great things coming up. We're working on the registry database. We've had one up, but we are working on that, making it a little more simpler. Mike Jones is really spearheading that, doing a lot of the coding for that. So we're excited about many of the things coming up for 2009 for Paranexus. And if you haven't been in the Paranexus Academy recently, we do have a new course up there. That's the Leading Paranormal Investigator Certification course. It's really a full-blown leadership and management course in a paranormal wrapper. It doesn't matter whether you're a ufologist or paranormal researcher or anything. It's an excellent and comprehensive leadership and management course that will help you in running your groups better, running your teams better, being a better leader, managing your time, delegating, inviting, and screening members, which is a big deal. Making sure you get the right folks there. So take a look at that at paranexusacademy.org. With that having been said, we're going to take just a short break, and we'll be back in just a minute. Hang in with us.
Hi, this is Doug Kelly, founder of the Spirit Team. We perform professional paranormal research and investigations at no charge to you. If you are experiencing mysterious events in your home or business, please contact us. We maintain your privacy, and we won't think you're crazy. And if you're a paranormal researcher, we offer an accredited certification course that will enhance your knowledge of the paranormal field and raise credibility with your clients. For more information, please visit our website at spiritteam.org. That's spiritteam with one T, .org.
Is there a suppression of UFO and alien information by our government?
Does the soul continue on after we die?
Climb aboard the black ship of Paranormal Radio with your host, Captain Jack, on Contact Talk Radio and KRWM 106.9 FM HD3. Or visit WBRTRadio.com for more information.
Where will you find a professional association of paranormal researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where can you get research training, share data, and network with other researchers?
Paranexus.org.
Where will you find a set of international standards for paranormal research groups?
Paranexus.org.
Paranexus is a global professional association of progressive paranormal investigators, parapsychologists, cryptozoologists, ufologists, and psychically gifted individuals focused on understanding the human condition through the scientific study of paranormal and psychical phenomena. And coming October 2008 to Tampa, Florida, the Paranexus Conference, a learning and networking event unlike any you've attended. Join us for 2 full days of innovative paranormal workshops. Participate in the Paranexus Challenge, where several teams will investigate a secret haunted location. Observe a live table-tipping seance at the stroke of midnight. Join us for the Spirits and Shadows Costume Ball. See old friends, meet new friends, win prizes, and have fun.
Paranexus.org.
A place to learn, a place to share, a place to network, a place to come together. Join us now at Paranexus.org.
And welcome back, everybody. This is Doug Kelly here with my co-host, Grant Rubendus, and we are talking with Jeff Danilek. Welcome back, Jeff.
Hey, guys.
It's been an interesting first hour, and we've got some more to talk about. We've been talking about UFOs and aliens, and we've been most recently here talking a little bit about reincarnation. And if you have a question, feel free to type it in the chat room, or you can give us a call. The numbers are on your screen, 347-945-7799. Or you can use the click the chat button there on your screen as long as you have a headset on your computer. So the direction I guess I'd like to go and get your thoughts, Jeff, is the connection between spirits and aliens. Have you come across that or any indication of that in your research?
Not really that much. Aliens tend to be physical forms. They tend to be biological units in most of the people that seem to have experienced them or encountered them. However, I do think that recently I have been seeing some efforts at channeling aliens. People have said that they have the ability to channel them under hypnosis. So that's kind of a new twist that you didn't see with aliens before. And it makes sense, actually, you think about it, if they have the ability to give us abduction hallucinations, they might have the ability to also communicate through us. So that's another area that needs to be explored a lot.
Well, I had the opportunity to presumably converse with an alien for 10 minutes through a channel, channeling, which was a rather fascinating experience. And the interesting thing, and the reason I'm asking this, is because there are, in my research, there are a lot of connections or a number of connections and similarities between a haunting and an abduction experience. They're not always the same, of course, but there are times when that seems to be the deal. For example, somebody sees dead grandfather, the spirit, presumably, and this person keeps coming back, and yet they have missing time. And upon further research investigation, it turns out they're an abductee. Another aspect of it is that there's quite a number of psychokinetic events associated with abductees. It's almost like once the abduction experience begins, or even prior, the psychic sensitivity of some of these abductees has gone up, and so they begin to experience PK events, psychokinetic events. Have you come across any of those types of things?
Very, very little, a couple of cases, but it makes sense that if extraterrestrials are manipulating your brain in some way, that perhaps they are opening up certain channels to perceptions that you might not have had before, or certain abilities that you might not have had previously. So there is some similarity between the supernatural and the extraterrestrial in the respect, I think, that they might both be tapping into the same sort of energies. Maybe one is doing it through a technological means and the other is more through a natural means. But in either case, they're getting similar effects by tapping into the same similar kinds of telekinetic and psychic energy that exists out there. Maybe they just know how to manipulate it with their technology in a way that we don't understand yet.
Sure. And that's always a possibility, too. Have you had an experience in your research? And I realize what I'm asking, with aliens being present but being cloaked in some way?
Not personally, but I am familiar with a case in which this gentleman had these entities in his home that would apparently have this ability to cloak themselves and be able to give kind of a shimmer effect. Which actually makes sense. If they wanted to observe humans living in very, in their natural habitat, you would want to find some method of being able to be present without being seen.
Mm-hmm.
So this didn't strike me as being remarkable, but I wish I had witnessed it myself, but unfortunately
sure.
I haven't been able to.
You've seen the pictures, though.
Actually, yes, I have, yes.
Yeah, and you know what? Something you may want to know is we've actually encountered that in a different case.
That's what you would expect. If this is really something that's going on among extraterrestrials and you'd want to see it more than once, you shouldn't see it only once and never again.
Mm-hmm. And so that's always fascinated me, too. All right, so what about Atlantis? That's obviously been a topic that's been around for a long, long time. That was like you growing up. I was incredibly interested in all of that stuff, and that along with the Bermuda Triangle and so on and so forth. What did you find out, or what did you come to in your?
Well, I have a book on Atlantis that came out last June, and it has kind of a different take on the thing. I looked at the major well-known theories, the Minoan theory, Atlantis was a continent, and the Atlantic Ocean theories, and essentially rejected all of them, because I believe what Plato was talking about was, he was talking about a global civilization that existed probably 10, 12,000 years ago, and Atlantis is basically just a metaphor for that global civilization. What I found more interesting in Plato's writings, more than his description of Atlantis, was his discussions about previous civilizations that had been destroyed by great deluges. And I thought that was, to me, more interesting because it's something that exists in many, many different cultures. The Polynesians, the Alaskan Indians, all these different groups that are separated by thousands of miles, have similar deluge stories, which all seem to be pointing to an event that occurred long in antiquity, long before recorded history. And so I postulate in my book that perhaps they were talking about a genuine global civilization that existed during the last ice age. Remember, during the ice age, while North America and Europe were covered by ice, really the tropics were still open, they were lush, the water level was a lot lower, so the entire archipelago of Indonesia was one large landmass. It was a continent the size of Europe, stretching all the way from Australia into India. So I thought, well, what if there was a global civilization? What if it did destroy itself? What evidence might it leave of itself behind? And how would it be interpreted by different surviving indigenous people in the generations afterwards? So that's basically what the book is about, and kind of put the idea out there and see if it flies.
Throw it on the wall and see if it sticks, huh?
That's right. I like to just kind of put those ideas out and let others take them and fly with them, run with them.
So do you think, Mike, that Atlantis was located more in the tropics, the tropical Atlantic, as opposed, because, you know, there's a lot of people have kicked around where Atlantis has actually been.
Bimini.
Yeah, Bimini. some people.
Well, what I thought interesting is when you go back to the last ice age, the ocean levels were about 200 to 400 feet lower. And once you lower the oceans, the entire South China Sea and all the areas around Indonesia are dry land. I mean, this is a huge area. This is a continent-sized area. So my belief that if you did have a civilization, you would almost be restricted to this region, kind of from the Indian subcontinent all the way down into northern Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where probably, I believe, it was largely located. It probably has smaller colonies elsewhere on the planet. But mostly it was right in that area of the Southwest Pacific.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, that's really a different kind of theory then, because for the most part, it's always been more or less in the Western Hemisphere.
Right. It's because of the word Atlantis. It's the same root word as Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
And so people pick up on that. They say, oh, well, that sounds like Atlantic, so therefore I must be talking about the Atlantic Ocean. But the Atlantic Ocean really has no place that you could have a continent. It's very deep. There's no submerged land masses except around Bimini, like you said. That area there is some shallow areas. But the rest of it is very deep, and it's been that way for millions of years. So I don't see how you could have a continent there. But there are places where there were continents that are now submerged because of the melting of the ice caps.
If Atlantis did indeed exist, do you think that civilization was technologically advanced?
I think it was as advanced as our own, and probably even more so in some ways.
Okay.
I postulate in my book that they may have actually destroyed themselves maybe through nuclear war.
Mm-hmm.
They were actually that advanced enough to destroy themselves on that level of biological warfare or all kinds of different ways they found of doing themselves in.
Well, there has been such speculation that there has been nuclear weapons used in antiquity. There's at least some evidence for that.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing that's really interesting about that, guys, is the fact that I just read an article a day or so ago about how scientists, that doesn't actually fit into the self-destruction theory, but it's another theory that I find fascinating, is scientists have now determined that in the year like 537 or 573 AD, that there was a comet strike or some sort of asteroid body crashed up in around the area of Greenland or in one of the oceans. And what happened was it caused, you know, a little mini ice age at that time. There is some documentation in ancient, I guess, text and stuff, but one of the biggest reasons why they felt that way was I guess paleontologists were in Greenland and they found shells and a number of things that they thought had been part of the debris that had been ejected for thousands and thousands of miles because the shells were totally out of character with their location and whatever earth boundary level they were digging in. But it was a very interesting thing, and it leads one to the conclusion that, you know, if a near-Earth object hit the Earth, the consequences would be far more devastating in many cases than a nuclear war.
Oh, absolutely, right. Even a supervolcano has the potential devastate
yeah.
the entire continent. So there's things other than nuclear war that could do it. But you have to find a mechanism that could completely destroy an advanced global civilization, leaving only the indigenous people. So it can't be something that would wipe out all life. It has to leave little groups of people, say Stone Age people, untouched, so that we have some way to rebuild.
Do you think, Jeff, that Stone Age, like let's say the Neanderthal or Cro-Magnon, existed at the same time as a more advanced race of humans on the planet?
I think that's entirely possible. As far as we know, I think the Neanderthals lived until about 12 to 16,000 years ago, which mm-hmm. would have been about the time that this would have occurred, this event, mm-hmm. if indeed it occurred. So they might have been among the victims. But I'm thinking more about the terms of the people living in the Amazon or in New Guinea in the deepest parts of the forest,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Who had no contact with civilization, therefore were not destroyed by it. In my book, I say it's not just in the nuclear war, but it's also a biological war. So, in other words, the population was decimated by a biological agent, which triggered the nuclear confrontation, which basically destroyed it. So the only people who wouldn't have been affected by it would have been the most isolated primitive groups. They would not have been affected as directly.
That would make some sense if you look at it from the standpoint. Let's just assume for the sake of an argument that you're correct, and that there was this continent over there, all of it was part of a landmass which connected Australia to the Asian continent. Excuse me, and assuming they had some sort of catastrophic event, a nuclear war, a comet strike, whatever, well, when does life start to re-evolve? And most of the anthropologists believe that when human beings emerge, they emerge out of Africa. And that would certainly fit very neatly into your, conception or your hypothesis that, these small groups of people living in isolated areas would have been the ones that survived. Because
not only that, but it's interesting that the Native Americans first came over around that time too, about 12,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So you think, maybe this was a group that moved out of that area once the continent subsided enough and moved into North America where they started over again. And of course, after a few generations, any knowledge of this previous civilization is gone.
Mm-hmm.
It just exists as mythology.
Mm-hmm.
And that certainly runs true in the Middle East, because if you go all the way back to the Babylonians, talk about the flood.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's where the actual Noah's flood in the Bible came from, the epics of Gilgamesh,
mm-hmm.
which
was
a much older Babylonian story, I believe. So,
mm-hmm.
and then that probably even goes back further than that. So it all seems to be talking about a major event that occurred in such distant past that it's really, it's distant past even to people who lived 6,000 years ago. That's how old it is.
Yeah.
So you can imagine what it is to us. And then I also postulate about why we don't see evidence of it. And I looked at how short-term our technology is in terms of surviving. There was a show on recently, Life After People.
Oh, yeah, sure. Great show. Yep.
And it showed how New York City, in just really 3,000 or 4,000 years, if you just walked away from it and just, left it, in 3,000 or 4,000 years, you wouldn't even know it had ever been there. All the skyscrapers, everything is gone. There's no evidence that there was ever a city there. And that's a city that's left intact. You can imagine if it was destroyed first. The process would be even quicker.
Well, think about that satellite the other day that caught the Egyptian ruins that people had overlooked. They caught it on satellite. It had been sitting there for thousands of years, and because of the terrain there, nobody really saw it. And then, and a satellite picked up it was an old temple or something.
Mm-hmm.
That went back, to I don't know whatever dynasty. Fascinating stuff.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So Jeff, in your travels over the last several years of writing on some of these different topics, what's it meant to you? What's been your spiritual journey? What have you learned that perhaps other might be of value to others?
Well, I've learned that the universe is a much bigger place than I ever imagined. When you look at the world through just the lens of, say, Christianity alone. You have everything kind of pigeonholed, and it's very neat and orderly, and you have it all laid out for you in the Bible, what you need to believe.
Right.
And once you leave that, and you start expanding your horizons beyond that, you start realizing, boy, this is a lot bigger than I had ever imagined it would be. And as a result, I think I've developed a deeper relationship with God, a deeper understanding of what God is to me. I see God in other people now more than I used to. Not everybody, of course, but I see more people than I used to.
What do you mean by that?
Just the folks that don't fish y'all.
Present company accepted,
Yeah.
But it's been a great spiritual adventure for me, as well as an intellectual journey to expand myself. I have no idea what I'm going to write next, what kind of thing I'm going to explore next. I could get a phone call tomorrow that'll start me on a whole new book, you know. And it's just that kind of a world I live in now that makes every morning interesting getting out of bed.
That's good. So, let's talk about ghosts a little bit. Now, as you did...
Well, I'm so glad. I was going to ask the same question, Doug.
Go ahead.
Great minds think alike. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, in researching your book, The Case for Ghosts, please refresh my memory. Were you able to accompany anyone on investigations?
Yeah, I did go on a couple of ghost hunts. And just wanted to see how they did it. You know, I was more interested, not so much in looking for ghosts, although I was very open to that, but I wanted to see what kind of techniques they used, what the equipment worked, how the equipment worked, you know, what the equipment was supposed to try to do, and just kind of get a feeling for how they did it. I didn't find much, but I thought they were both really interesting. I think ghost hunting is very difficult, though. It's a long, long hours. Of great boredom, punctuated by short moments of great fear, you know. but it's always kind of fun to poke around these old buildings at night and stuff, and just to kind of see what's going on out there. But did see one thing I couldn't explain.
Yeah.
That was on board the Queen Mary.
Tell us about it.
I was coming down a passageway about 2 o'clock in the morning, and there was this little gray orb. On the floor, looking about like a basketball or something. And I was walking towards it, and I was looking at it and thinking, what is that thing? You know, I kept getting closer and closer, and then all of a sudden it kind of skidded around the corner, and by the time I got there and looked, it was gone. And I had no idea what it was. I can't say it was a ghost, but it was certainly something that I couldn't explain. That's the closest to having a paranormal experience, I guess, I've had.
Was it translucent?
Well, it was quite a distance away, so I couldn't get quite that. It struck me as being mostly opaque, you know, not solid like a bowling ball or something, but it looked to me like, I suppose if I was to compare it to something, it would be maybe the head of a mop, a gray mop, you know, that kind of a texture, but at that distance. But it wasn't connected to anything. It was just kind of by itself, and it seemed to be able to move very quickly. Once I got close enough to identify it.
Was it sitting on the floor or hovering above it?
It seemed to be close to the floor. It could have been hovering, but if it was hovering just a few inches above it.
Interesting. So, you know, let me point out that this kind of a sighting is much different than the typical orb photos that so many people get, which is really a naturally explained phenomena. And so I just wanted to point that out, not to you, Jeff, but just for the listening audience, because they probably well know our position on orbs, which is they're nothing. But the ones that you can see with the naked eye, you know, now we're talking about something entirely different. So
it's a little bit different, yeah. Actually, for your listeners, I do have on my site, I have a page of authentic ghost photos, and then I also have a page of anomalous ghost photos. And those show orbs, myths, ectoplasms, things that are commonly mistaken for spiritual energies. So they might find that interesting to look at both real and kind of fake ghost pictures side by side and get a feel for what they're looking for.
Jeff, how long were you on the Queen Mary?
Well, I was there for a seminar for a couple of days. I was with the ghost hunters in that group, and they were doing a seminar. And so it was just a couple of days, I guess, about a weekend.
There's been some really interesting things occur on. There's been a lot of very odd noises that they've recorded that are really kind of fascinating. Did anybody in the group that you were with during that time hear any of the noises? It wasn't that Queen Mary involved in a collision at one time many years ago and guys were trapped in the bow or something?
Well, what happened in the Second World War, of course, the Queen Mary was a troop transport. And it was under being escorted by other warships, and apparently one of the warships turned in front of it, one of the British cruisers, and got cut in half by it, by the Queen Mary. The Queen Mary wasn't seriously damaged, but the cruiser sank. It took about 400 men down with it in about 10 minutes. And they've had reports of seeing sailors below decks and, you know, apparitions in military uniform. And then one time they left a tape recorder in the bow section where the collision actually occurred. And they left it on overnight, just running overnight. and they did pick up about 15 seconds of what sounded like the crushing of metal and water pouring in.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like it was like a kind of a loop. It had actually caught that.
Yeah, all residual kind of stuff going
right,
on there.
Right, residual thing. So I think that's a really interesting place. And to answer your question, people did have experiences besides myself on the Queen Mary during. They had ghost hunts they set up, and so you could go on different nights and go and look at some of the areas of the ship that were closed off to the public. And one of the ghost hunters, not the ghost hunter, but one of the gentlemen there that was involved, I asked him if he'd seen anything, and he told me that on the first night he had gotten there, he was going through the engine room. He had permission to go through that area. And he came across a guy in overalls, kind of coveralls, who was working on something, and he looked up and was startled. This gentleman that he encountered was startled by his presence, and he said it looked like he was saying, "You can see me?" You know, it was like that kind of a thing. Like he couldn't believe that he could be seen, and then he kind of like vanished. So the guy encountered this apparition who was actually as startled apparently by him as he was by it, and just kind of. Apparently, ghosts don't always know that they can be seen. That's what I found interesting. They seem like there are times when they know they can be seen, but there are also times they appear where they don't realize it.
Yeah, they're just as startled by the humans that they encounter.
And maybe just as afraid of them, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the movie Brothers, you know?
It's the matter of where your perception is, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Or where your viewpoint is.
But it was a kind of spooky place. It was a lot of fun. I would go back in a heartbeat, but got to have a reason to.
So you're doing a lot of lecturing.
Yeah, I try to keep up on that. I do a lot of radio, and I also teach classes out of the Colorado Free University here in Denver. I do UFO courses. I do reincarnation, ghosts. I try to keep my hand in it as much as I can until I get my own talk show.
Yeah.
And go on. Cool. Go that route, I guess.
I know two guys that would love to come. Hey, just baiting. Seating.
So, Jeff, in all the years of research, what's the wildest thing that you've come across?
The wildest thing? Well, personally, I mean, I think the UFO I saw last January was, to me, still extraordinary. I never expected in a million years to actually encounter something like that. And
how far away
were
you from it?
How what?
How far away were you? Was it up above you in the air? Was that at an angle to you, or
it was
how far away
above,
would you say?
I'm going to guess it was 100 to 200 feet overhead. This is in broad
daylight.
These aren't nighttime things.
Oh, okay.
This is the broad daylight, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And it was a couple hundred, I'm guessing a couple hundred feet. It's very difficult to gauge distance in the air sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But based upon their size and how they moved, I'm guessing it could have been that much further overhead, which makes sense if it was a display, because they wanted just us to see it. They didn't want the whole city of Denver to see it, even though it was right
mm-hmm.
in downtown Denver. But
mm-hmm.
just so people standing out in that courtyard would have seen this. And so it was like enough to convince people there that there was something going on, but not so much as to get a lot of media involved.
Mm-hmm. So what was the reaction of the folks around you? Were everybody just kind of standing there going like, whoa, jaw-dropping sort of reaction? Or
no, they were actually pretty quiet. A few of them were taking pictures. A couple of, you know, take their cell phones and were trying to snap pictures.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if any of these turned out or what happened to them. I've been trying to find out from the organizers of this conference, you know, what happened with all these people. And then some people kind of laughed it off, or I think some people get a little afraid when they encounter something like this
mm-hmm.
and they don't want to accept what they saw. And so they'll
mm-hmm.
come up with all sorts of explanations. Oh, it must have been a balloon.
What do
you
know? Think the press still, after all these years, and I mean, I'm not, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that UFOs definitely exist, but why do you think the press continues to treat anybody who has a sighting as a crackpot and put it in a category where we're going to completely laugh it off?
Well, I don't know. I think that the crackpots are the people that make the best press.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you want a 30-second soundbite, you want to get the most colorful character you can find. If you get the most competent observer, they're often fairly dull, you know, because they're going to tell you very, very matter-of-factly what they saw. Well, that's not good TV. Since you're trying to find the person who's, you know, I'll tell you, it was a great big ball, and it was overhead, and you get that guy on there. So it makes it look like the media is not on board. But I also have found people who have worked with the media on a more direct basis, and they have found that a lot of these people are very open to this idea that there might be something out there. Because these are the same people. They grew up on Star Trek just like everybody else.
Sure. You
know? So they're open to some of these ideas. Sometimes the older, you know, the older established editors and producers are like, you know, let's not go there. But the younger people, the younger reporters and media types are more open to what's going on.
Well, that's.
I think they would love to get a UFO on tape. If they could get one, my goodness, they'd be all over the place with that.
Oh, yeah. I think it would give them the proof they need to state their position on it. You know, they're like a lot of scientists, and I mean, you know, to believe in UFOs or anything paranormal or anomalous like this stuff in mainstream science is an absolute no-no. Now, many do, and many go there, but there's a lot more who believe it, but who don't necessarily go there and who won't tackle it.
Public. Well, with scientists especially, you know, you have that credential issue. You work for 20, 30 years to get, you know, peer-reviewed articles published to get those credentials, and then you come out and say, oh, by the way, I believe in UFOs. Well, that can really mess up your
career. Well, that's career suicide.
I've encountered that a number of times. People off the record are willing to talk about it, but they don't want to say anything on the record. And I can kind of understand that, you know. It's just human nature to want to protect yourself.
What's your take, Jeff? What's your take on all these UFO whistleblowers, government whistleblowers?
Boy, I'm real leery of some of these people. It just strikes me as unlikely, I guess. They never really seem to deliver the goods. They tell you all these stories about what happened, and they saw this and they saw that, and they witnessed hanging, and there was a UFO, but they never can ever come up with anything that makes it more than a story. And that's
really
frustrating to me.
They weave a good yarn, but there's no hard data.
Right. You know, and they tell some of the most extraordinary stories that are so difficult to believe. And the problem is that in the UFO world, in the paranormal community in general, there's that want to believe. So if someone comes up with a story that is reinforcing your basic premise, you're going to latch onto that.
And let's just take the opportunity to remind and to state, you can't approach paranormal research with belief or disbelief. You have to approach it without preconceived notions. And we stress that constantly at Paranexus and on this show. You have to just see what you got, and otherwise you corrupt your evidence. You basically corrupt your
invalidate it.
Yeah, and you're without objectivity. You lose that objectivity. So you've got to go and see what you got, and see what the evidence supports, rather than trying to fit that evidence to a particular belief. And that also leads into a point that crossed my mind a couple of times when you've mentioned some things that. There is a huge difference between what you see on TV and what you researchers experience in the field. You know, as you've mentioned, you know, TV is about entertainment, and the
unfortunately
it is. And unfortunately, so many of the in the paranormal research community, especially, and I'm particularly in the ghost hunting aspect of it, is the you know, they've been watching TV. They've been watching Ghost Hunters. They've been watching TAPS. And so, you know, they're going into this thinking that they're going to get something or see something exciting. And the reality of it is long hours of reviewing evidence, mostly to find nothing. And so, you know, if you want to be a serious paranormal researcher, you have to understand that it's not all that. It, you know, they're not all the thrill time.
You have to love staying up till 3 o'clock in the morning and then driving home.
At least. And it's even worse if you're a Bigfoot hunter.
And I'll tell you, you know what's the most scary part of it all, fellas? And I know that Doug will be, this will resonate with Doug, is what's the best part and even more frightening is leaving an investigation scene at 2 o'clock in the morning and getting lost.
You've never done that?
Not any researches that I've ever known, right, Doug?
Yeah, right. Oh, God, they were in. Yeah, they were.
Well, no, I was
something followed us home that night. That's the only explanation I have.
Yeah, that's it. We had missing.
No, I was just going to say it's even worse for the Bigfoot researchers because they have to stay out there in the dark in the forest all night for days on end. You know, to find nothing.
No.
Yeah,
those hunting's a lot better.
Yeah, got a roof over your head at least most of the time.
Yeah.
Well, all right. We've had an interesting conversation, you know, and I tell you, I'm glad that we had a chance to get you on the show, Jeff. I'm not sucking up, and I'm not kidding when I say that when I read your book a few months ago, The Case for Ghosts, I think I put it down and said, you know, we got to talk to him, because it was refreshing, the objective approach that you took that was not. It was very professionally done. That's what I felt. And I thought, I'm so glad he did that, because anybody who reads it is going to understand that it's much different than what you would typically see on TV. In other words, you know, we get an orb photo, or we get a photo with one of those camera shakes, you know, the energy rods, that kind of stuff. And all of this stuff is explainable, and yet so many out there put it up as evidence of a paranormal, and it's just not. It's just, it basically translates into, I want to believe, and so I'm gonna make it so. And so I highly recommend that book, The Case for Ghosts, and if your other books are anything like that, and I'm sure they are, you know, that you've got some good stuff going there, and I commend you for that.
Well, I appreciate that there, Doug. It's always nice to get a good verbal review on these things. You know, when you write a book and you put it out there in the universe, you don't know whether you've helped or hurt, you know. So it's nice to get some positive feedback and see that people are finding what you've written to be interesting and useful to them, and so that's enough to keep me going for however many years I got left on this planet.
Well, you know,
the important thing is that you approach it in a scientific manner, and the easy way to do it would be to come out with something sensational and does nothing, makes no contribution to whatever research foundation we're trying to build.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, our hats are off to you, Jeff, for your good works and your many years of research. And, you know, we certainly like to have you come back on the show sometime and talk about some other topics. I'm interested in reincarnation, and you're the first guest that we've had on here, so we're going to have you back again soon. Talk some more about reincarnation.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to talk about it. It's one of my favorite subjects.
And, you know, as you've been talking here, I've just been thinking that the thing I think I appreciate the most is the rational approach to these topics. That's what impressed me the most, Jeff, is the rational. And I can't stress that enough. It's so important, and it's so important to us. In fact, one of our mottos is do no harm. And I'm happy to say that you did no harm. You did good with that. I'm not going to continue. I don't do this very often. Ask Grant, but I was impressed.
Yeah, he's giving you high praise. So.
Yeah, so.
Well, thank you.
Anyway.
I also wanted to let people know that I write this stuff for a lay audience. There are people out there who write in a purely scientific sense, and that's useful, but it can also be very dry.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I try to bring this stuff into, because I'm a layman myself. I'm not a scientist. You know, I don't even have a college degree. So I don't like to read books that are very difficult, you know, so I like to try to bring it into more of a layman's language and make it more conversational, even fun sometimes.
Yep, mm-hmm. I concur. That's my style as well. Make it simple. Simplify it. Don't need
keep
to confound
people. That's right. That's it.
You're going to lose folks. You know, if you go to the other side, you're just not going to keep them, you know, interested.
All right,
yeah,
so audience, go take a look at Jeff's site, ourcuriousworld.com. Read his books. I know I bought mine in the bookstore. Are they generally in the bookstore, Jeff?
Yeah, they're in Barnes & Noble, Borders, and you can order them through my site or, pretty much anywhere.
Okay.
I think we saw one of your books, your newest book, advertised on The Anomalous, too. The Anomalous website. Yeah.
Cool.
I think you're on there. So. Oh, yeah.
So good stuff. Well, we're going to wrap up tonight's show. We've been talking with Jeff Danilek, author, researcher, and great guy. That's going to cost you, Jeff. That one's going to cost you.
That's in the mail.
So it's been great, and I've enjoyed it. And we will have you come back. We'll talk about reincarnation. We'll talk about those kinds of things. We appreciate everybody's time listening to us tonight, or if you're listening to the archive, we appreciate your time. We invite you to come over and join us at Paranexus, join in the vision, join us in building this global network of trained researchers, and join us at the Paranexus Academy, too. A lot of people have been waiting for this leadership course, and it's out now, and it's been getting some great reviews. So take a look at it, and the beautiful thing about the leadership course is that it will also benefit you secularly. If you are a manager at work, you won't find better leadership training. And it's stuff I've been training managers, CEOs, leaders for years and years in my corporate seminars and my public seminars. So it's really the best of what I've not only learned in my own experience, but what I've learned from my own research and assertive communication skills, advanced communication skills, management skills, and you'll never find this quality of training anywhere near the tuition. Just go take a look at what leadership courses cost. So take a look at ParanexusAcademy.org, and next week, we can't tell you who's going to be on next week, but we will announce that on the Paranexus website as well as in the newsletter. Jeff, thanks so much for taking your time to join us tonight. We appreciate it.
Grant, thanks a lot. It's been a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
It was a real pleasure having you, Jeff.
Yeah, and if you'll hang with us just a moment, we will bid everyone adieu. Thanks again so much, everyone. We'll talk to you next week. Good night.
And remember, if you want to be a guest on the show, just send us an email or give us a call.
Take care, everyone.
Good night.
It's Paranexus Universe.